Well, good morning. It is great to be in the Star City, and I apologize we're just a little bit late, but better late than never. But I have been so impressed with your medical school here, and you know, I just want to pay tribute. Charles Steger, the late Charles Steger, had just tremendous vision back in 2007 to start Virginia Tech Carilion Medical School, and it's just grown by leaps and bounds, and we couldn't be prouder in the Commonwealth of Virginia for all the great work that you all are doing right here in Roanoke. It's a pleasure to be with you all this morning, and I appreciate you being here bright and early to really talk about a topic that is near and dear to my heart as a physician, but also I think something that is a tremendous challenge for the Commonwealth of Virginia right now. And I have with me Ryan Hall, who I will introduce in just a bit. But it's great to see some white coats in the audience. It wasn't that long ago that I was sitting in your seat, if you will. And I know sometime that you feel tired and not getting enough sleep and doing a lot of studying. But I want to tell you that you are entering medicine, I believe, at one of the most exciting times. And I'm almost envious that I can't go back and start over and be in your seat again. And I'll tell you why. We've now mapped out the human genome. We understand proteomics, the receptors, all of those things that we know so much more about now. And the diseases that I have taken care of and the disorders for probably 25 to 30 years, diseases such as Duchenne's muscular dystrophy and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease and Lou Gehrig's disease, we are right on the cusp of not only holding those folks' hands but finding a definitive cure. And that's exciting. And one of the things that I bring to the table as a physician and now as governor, and why I'm so excited about the research that's going on right here in Roanoke, and that is, if we're that close to finding cures for these diseases, let's do it right here in Virginia. So I'm excited for you all. It is interesting how your life sometimes takes twists and turns. And Pam and I came back from Germany in 1992 with two small children. I started my medical practice, about 30 of us, pediatric subspecialists, started children's specialty group. That's now grown to about 100 pediatric subspecialists. We employ about 250 individuals in Hampton Roads. And then in 2006, 2007 timeframe, I became very frustrated with what was going on in healthcare. And I was actually talking to our chairman one day, Hal Jennings, going over our research, grants, et cetera. And he said, "Ralph, how you doing?" I said, "Dr. Jennings," I said, "I'm frustrated. I'm spending more time on the phone with insurance companies, getting things authorized, and I'm spending seeing my patients." Anyway, long story short, he said, "Why don't you do something about it?" I said, "All right." So the first bit of advice, I'm going to give you a little advice today, but if you so choose to run for elected office, first thing you need to do is talk it over with your spouse, okay? So I got that clear, but anyway, I ran for the Senate in 07 and was successful, and then ran for re-election in 11, ran for lieutenant governor in 13, and then last year in 2017 ran for governor. But I titled the talk this morning from how we get to policy, from practice to policy. And so bringing our experience in as citizen legislators, the first piece of legislation that I introduced and passed was a smoking ban in restaurants. That was something that, as a pediatrician, I didn't appreciate, inhaling secondhand smoke. And that was, as you might imagine, an uphill battle in the Commonwealth of Virginia, but we were able to get that done. We've done a lot of work with autism, making sure that these children are diagnosed at an early age and then receive the treatment they need. We know that their prognosis is much better if we can diagnose them earlier. We've done a lot of work, as you might imagine, as a child neurologist. I see a lot of individuals with concussions. So we came up with a protocol a set of guidelines of how to manage concussions in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And then finally, as Steve said, we were able to expand health care to close to 400,000 Virginians this last year. So there are opportunities to bring our experience into policymaking. And when I was in the Senate and as Lieutenant Governor, those are, on paper at least, part-time jobs. So I continued to be part of our practice. I continued to see patients. And so when I was elected for governor in November of last year, one of the first things that I said was, I want to still see patients. And we have some lawyers, actually, in the audience. And the lawyer said, that's probably not a good idea at this stage of your life. And so I accepted their advice, but I said, I might not be able to see patients, but I can still teach. And so I have been going around and talking to students and residents and providers about an issue, like I said, that's very important to me. And one of the things that we do in neurology, when we have our grand rounds or what we call our neurology conference, we like to bring a patient because there's nothing more powerful than for you to hear the story from the patient. And I will take a history this morning from Ryan. We also will often do a physical exam, a neurological exam. That's one of the ways we teach. We've agreed we're not going to do any exams this morning, so he's happy about that. But I do want to, another piece of advice I want to give to you young providers, and that is the history. The history is the most important thing that you can do at the bedside. We have all these fancy tests, MRIs and CAT scans and lab tests, but if you let the patient tell you what's wrong with them 99 times out of 100, they'll lead the way for you. So always listen, and I remind our students and residents that if after you have taken your history, you don't know what's wrong with your patient, you need to keep asking questions. So don't ever forget that. But I'd like to introduce to you a friend of mine. He's out from Allegheny County. He has traveled around the Commonwealth with me. He has a powerful story to tell, a difficult story. And I commend him for being with me and helping spread this message across the Commonwealth. But please welcome to Roanoke, Mr. Ryan Hall. Ryan, thank you for being here. Good to see you. This is dangerous. These chairs have wheels on them, so that probably means if they don't like what we're saying, they'll just yank us and we'll be right out of here. But Ryan, it's good to see you again. How you been?
Doing pretty good.
Good.
I think
good.
I've gained about 10 pounds since the last time I seen you, so that's
all right.
Long.
Well, you're looking good. You grew up in Allegheny County in a small town called Covington. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what it was like for you in high school.
You know, Covington is a rural town, you know, not much to do. Play sports, go to school, come to Roanoke on the weekend, go to the mall.
Uh-huh. You were quite a football player, I understand.
I was all right.
Uh-huh. Tell me about that.
Well, we, you know, stayed in the weight room, you know, and whenever I had, you know, my breakout season was junior year, and then really hit the weights hard in between junior and senior year, and was getting ready. You know, I was talking to a few schools. You know, I talked to your alma mater, BMI.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to go there, and you know, a couple smaller schools, D3 schools, D2 schools, and you know, I was getting ready for the season. So.
Before we get to what happened to you on the football field, you were an honor student in high school.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and tell us about the clubs and your involvement with the church and your family. If you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was in Beta Club, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Model General Assembly, held the office of Youth Attorney General. My senior year, I had my own office in the Capitol building. I was going to run against Ralph, but I didn't make it.
Glad you did. And your father, who's with us today, your father's a sheriff.
Yes.
Yeah, I grew up, my father was a judge, so we kind of had to behave ourselves, didn't we, when we were coming
yes,
along.
So,
And you were playing football, and tell us about you had a pretty significant injury. Tell us what happened.
Well, I wasn't supposed to be playing in the game anyway because I had a boxer fracture in my hand, and it was a rivalry game senior year. You know, I had to play. And so, you know, I wore the cast down for, you know, a couple weeks. So I played wide receiver. And the third play of the game, a pile that was tackling our quarterback landed on my leg. My leg was caught, and I suffered a tibial plateau fracture, dislocated kneecap, and torn ACL, MCL, and meniscus. Mm.
And they helped you off the field and took you to the hospital, I take it?
Yes, sir.
You had a lot of pain?
Yes, sir.
What did they do for you at the hospital?
Well, it was liquid morphine on the way to the hospital, and then whenever I got to the hospital, it was liquid dilaudid. Mm-hmm. And this happened on a Friday, and they didn't want to do surgery right away because they said there was a lot of blood on the inside of the leg. So they scheduled surgery for Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And the dilaudid, when they would give that to you, did that take the edge off the pain?
Yes, sir.
And to the point where when the pain would come back, you would ask for another dose?
Yes, sir.
And how long did you stay in the hospital?
I stayed in the hospital for a week, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did they try to switch you from dilaudid to another medication?
Yeah, on the day before the surgery, I think they tried to switch me to Percocet.
Mm-hmm.
And because every time I could get the dilaudid, I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And but my leg was hurting at this point. And I was a little dehydrated, and my leg would cramp. And whenever it would cramp, you know, I had a broken bone in there. And
right. So that you stayed in the hospital for about a week, and then you went home. Were you on pain medication when you left the hospital?
Yeah, I was on Percocet, 10 milligram, and 50 milligram Tramadol.
Uh-huh. And you actually hurt yourself again? Tell us about that.
Well, we had a derecho hit. I know you guys remember. And we have a 100-foot waterfall near where I live called Falling Spring. And you're not supposed to, but we go down to the bottom and swim.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was trying to be Tarzan or something. And I jumped off a rock into what I thought was deep water, and the water was about 3 inches deep. And I broke the tibia again.
Uh-huh. And you required some medication again for pain?
Yes, sir.
At some point, Ryan, through all this, did you say to yourself, I've got a problem, this is getting away from me?
Well, I didn't realize that I had a problem until I started getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever I didn't have the pills.
Tell me about that. This is really an important point. A lot of people, that when we talk about addiction, they think people are trying to get that next dose because they want to get high. But there's this phenomenon called dope sick, and it's the symptoms that one goes through when they're withdrawing from medication. Tell us how that feels.
The worst case of the flu that you've ever had in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrible.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the flu, you...
You feel cold, but you're sweating, diarrhea, achy, can't sleep.
How did this start? I mean, in order to get that next dose to relieve those symptoms, what would you do?
Lie to my parents, try to get, well, I worked until, you know, dope sick. I got so bad where, you know, I would be dope sick and I couldn't go to work because I felt so bad. And then I would ask my parents for money, and then, you know, that ran out, and then I, you know, resulted, you know, stealing, and, you know, I wrote checks that weren't mine. And
at some point, you weren't able to get prescriptions. So how did you get your narcotics?
Well, a guy that I work with, you know, I would occasionally, you know, take pills, and he said, you know, if you like pills, you should try heroin. And I never tried heroin, never even heard of heroin in Covington. And he knew some guys in Roanoke, and we came over here, and I tried heroin. And
you got to the point where did you actually start selling?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And tell me about, you know, one of the issues with heroin that's so dangerous is a lot of the heroin has fentanyl. Some of it has what we call carfentanyl. Did you ever use fentanyl?
Yes, sir. The heroin that they did the control by that I got the drug charge with, they sent it to the Virginia State Police lab, and it came back as fentanyl, mm-hmm. powder fentanyl.
How much fentanyl were you taking?
I was doing 10 bags, which in street terms is known as a bundle, which is a gram, and I was doing all of those in one shot at one time.
Did you ever overdose?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Did they have to reverse your symptoms with Narcan, or you actually had the Narcan?
I've had the Narcan one time. I believe I've overdosed more times than that, but mm-hmm. just didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're dealing, and you were arrested, and eventually, where did you end up?
I went to jail for 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. How are you doing now?
Well, I'm doing great.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm over a year sober, going on a year and a half sober now.
And you're engaged?
Recently engaged, yeah. Recently baptized.
Uh-huh. Good for you.
And torn with the best governor that Virginia's ever had.
Don't worry, I'm not running for anything. So I'm going to ask you a couple more questions, and then we're actually going to watch a video about this story. As a provider, obviously this started with prescription medications, narcotics, for a legitimate problem, a fractured leg. What could people like me do to prevent people like you from going down this path?
I feel that at some point, you know, if you know you're getting a certain dosage per day, that you know the patient has to be weaned off the dose. Mm-hmm. I got painkillers for maybe 90 days, and then on the 91st day, I had nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's got to be, you know, if you're taking a 10 milligram, then maybe take that for a month, then 7.5 for a month, and then mm-hmm. a 5 for a month. And, you know, of course you're going to feel a little uncomfortable, mm-hmm. but it's not going to be as severe. You know.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's difficult for providers sometimes is if I, as the provider, as you, as the patient, I know that you've had to have a challenge. And sometimes we don't want certainly be confrontational, but how would you recommend a doctor or provider such as myself, if I know, Ryan, I know you're addicted to narcotics and I need to help you, how should I approach you so that you'll respect what we're trying to do?
Humanize with the patient, sympathize with the patient. I'm sure, you know, a lot of your lives, You have someone in your family or close friend that's been touched by addiction, and don't look down on the person. You know, speak to them more as a friend and not a mm-hmm. A boss or mm-hmm. trying to tell them what to do. Let them know what you can offer and what you can do to help. And you know, it's always their decision whether they want the help to receive mm-hmm. the help or not. But put it out there what you can do and how you can help.
And we kind of touched on it a little bit, but this not only affected you, obviously, and hasn't affected you, but how did it affect your family, your friends, your relationships? If you could touch on that just briefly.
I probably didn't see my dad for a couple of years, because whenever you're doing heroin and selling heroin, you don't want to go around the sheriff. I weigh, I think, maybe 200 pounds now. I think when I went to jail, I weighed like 156 pounds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My fiance was pregnant whenever I went to jail, and I got out on a 12-hour furlough to see my daughter born at the amazing Roanoke Memorial Hospital. And then I had to go back in. I missed the whole first year of her life. No first steps, no first Christmas, no first words.
Okay. One last question I have, and again, thank you so much for sharing your story with all of us. The dope sick is just so powerful, and the need to get that next dose, and you want it to be a good dose. We have, I'm going to talk about the number of deaths we have in Virginia each year. But what I heard that was really eye-opening to me is that if an addict hears that two blocks down the road that there have been several deaths from an overdose, that's where they want to go to get their next dose. Can you just, is that accurate?
Well, and whenever you're in addiction or whatever, the sickest things, you know, tend to amuse you. And it's on, in street terms, it's called a hot shot. And what the dealer will do is he will give someone pure fentanyl, pure heroin, let that person overdose, let them be found. You know, it'll go on the news. They'll say, oh, it's all printed on these bags. And then everybody will want to go get that. And by that time, he will, you know, cut his drug and then, you know, sell it as if, you know, it's the most powerful thing. Because, you know, people, whenever they're in their addictive mind, they want the best that you can get. And so.
Ryan, thank you. Please give Ryan Hall a hand. Thank you. I want to just try to reinforce a couple of the things that we've talked about. But first of all, as Ryan said, this is a chronic problem. This is not something that can be on medications for a week or 2 weeks, be discharged from a hospital, and then said no follow-up. So we really need to follow these individuals closely. There is no question that there's a predisposition genetically to addiction. We are learning more about that every day. I mentioned some numbers. 1,227 opioid deaths in 2017. That's more than we see from automobile accidents, more than we see from gun violence. And if you look at all addictions, 1,534 in 2017. And the point, the reason that I am traveling around the Commonwealth and talking to my fellow providers that I've heard this story over and over again, and this journey, this path of addiction often starts with a prescription from someone like me. And so we need to look at more innovative ways of treating both acute and chronic pain. And just so you know, this is as common as diabetes and depression. I would also make the point that it is a problem that doesn't discriminate. It could be someone in your family, your neighbor, friend, etc. I think the other point we need to make, and I hear this in my daily life of policymaking, sometimes people say, well, these are bad people. They're thugs. They're out there selling drugs. They're people just like you and me that have unfortunately taken a wrong turn, a wrong path. These are just some statistics. As you see, in 2015, 1,028 deaths. Between 2015 and 2016, there was an increase in opioid overdose by 39%. Between 16 and 17, an increase of close to 8%. And as I said earlier, that's more deaths than will occur on our highways and from gun violence. I thought this was an interesting slide. If you look at the top graph, the black graph, that's all opioids, overdose from all, and deaths from all opioids. The blue graph is from prescription medications. And That's fairly flat, and I think there's some things that we've done over the last year with what we call prescription monitoring program. One of the challenges, especially out in the Southwest with so many states surrounding Virginia, was doctor shopping. People would actually travel across the borders and be able to obtain prescriptions. But what's really, I think, alarming is the red graph. And you ask, why is this increase? And this graph is with heroin and fentanyl. And we saw in the last 2 to 3 years, as Ryan said, heroin is now being laced with fentanyl and even sometimes carfentanyl, which is 100 times more potent than fentanyl. It's often used in veterinarian clinics. And if an individual is exposed to heroin and it has either fentanyl or carfentanil in it and they don't have something to reverse the deadly side effects, they will become a statistic. An interesting slide here, the blue squares, the blue graph, this is first time exposure to opioids. And it used to be that heroin was the most common culprit of first-time exposure. But if you look at the bottom graph that goes up, it starts really in the 1990s. And we have to ask ourselves, what happened in the 1990s? And in 1995, OxyContin was approved by the FDA. And OxyContin was marketed to people like you and me as not being addictive. As a matter of fact, they said there was less than a 1% chance, because this was a long-acting preparation, there was less than a 1% chance that your patients would become addicted. And then they said to people like me that if your patient came back to you and said that they needed more OxyContin, it wasn't because they were addicted. It's because we were under-treating them. And thus, the rest is history. And so I'm not here to throw stones at pharmaceutical companies, but there is a responsibility there. And I believe she is in our audience, and I would highly recommend there is a book called Dope Sick. And Dope Sick is authored by Beth Macy. Beth, if you could just wave to the crowd. Please, if you're interested in this, and you should be, read that book. And I thank you for writing that. It's just a powerful book with a powerful message and so well written. So thank you for being part of the remedy here for this challenge that we have across the Commonwealth. I am not here this morning to lecture you on how to manage acute and chronic pain, but I did want to just highlight a couple things regarding acute pain. And obviously Tylenol would not have touched what he was going through, but there's nothing wrong with Tylenol, nothing wrong with non-steroidals such as we call them, Advil, Motrin, Naprosyn, those types of medicines. IV Toradol is often used now for acute pain and works quite well if a patient can tolerate it. Regional nerve blocks are always also an option. Moving to the right side of the screen, we really need to get away from these emojis. When I was in your shoes and seeing making rounds in the hospital, often right on the wall or over top the bed were these symbols. And how are you feeling today? Are you a number one, happy, smiling, or are you a number 9 or 10 in the worst pain that you've ever experienced? And if someone said, well, I'm a 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, then the next response was from someone like me, well, you must need some more pain medications. And I would remind you that we obviously want to keep our patients comfortable, but pain sometimes can be a good thing. That can lead us to where the problem in our bodies are. So don't ever underestimate how valuable pain can be in treating patients. And as far as chronic treatment, we have tricyclic antidepressants, Elavil, and I apologize, I'm going back and forth from trade names to generics, but most people have heard of Elavil. Pamelor is another one, nortriptyline. There are several anticonvulsants, Tegretol, Topamax, Trileptal, Neurontin, that can be used successfully. Cymbalta is an antidepressant that is now used for chronic pain. Lyrica, which is pregabalin, can be effective. Acupuncture is certainly an option, as is Botox. As a child neurologist, I treat a lot of migraines with Botox, and it works quite well. The point I wanted to make is that for individuals that come in with chronic pain, often they can have comorbid conditions, and don't ever ignore those. They can come in with depression. They may have an illness like diabetes. They may have post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of things could be contributing to their picture of chronic pain. So, again, make sure you take a history and treat the whole patient, as we say. The other point I would make on this slide is that this is why research centers, like right here at Carilion, are so important. We need to continue to promote research and development, looking for new agents, new ways, more innovation, more technology to treat both acute and chronic pain. Just some things at the state level that we're doing. We have what we call the ARTS program, which is run by Medicaid in Virginia. It's Addiction and Recovery Treatment Services. Because of Medicaid expansion, we now have better reimbursement rates for individuals that are taking care of those that are addicted, so we're moving in the right direction there. Provider development and awareness. We have certified substance abuse counselors. We also have a waiver for primary care providers. A lot of continuing medical education for those that are interested in, number one, how to detect, how to recognize addiction, and then how to treat it. That wasn't taught to me when I was in medical school. So if you're interested, there are continuing education programs of how you can help these individuals. I think it's also clear that now, in addition to just using abstinence from narcotics, that medically assisted treatment, and I think Ryan alluded to that when he was saying you just can't send someone out and not taper them or wean them off of the narcotics that they've been on. And then obviously the counseling is so important alongside the medically assisted treatment. And this is just to run through a couple other measures that we're taking. Opioid prescribing regulations. If you look at the data, there are some individuals, remember I talked about the genetic predisposition, there are some individuals, if they're exposed to a narcotic for 3 or 4 days, they can become addicted. So we have a new regulation in Virginia that you can only write a 7-day supply. Some people think that we should back that down to maybe even 5 days. So that's certainly open for discussion. Drug takebacks. I can promise you, if you go to most people's homes and look in the medicine cabinet, there are medicines that are no longer being used. And so we encourage our patients to take those medications back to the pharmacy. Are there even kits that you can take from the pharmacy to your home to destroy those medications? PMP reports, I mentioned that earlier, the prescription monitoring program. We just launched a program where acute care centers, emergency departments can now communicate with each other to receive records from other facilities so that if a patient is doctor shopping, we can better keep up with that. As far as harm reduction, as I said, if an individual gets hold of heroin that's laced with either fentanyl or carfentanil and they don't have access to Narcan, which is naloxone, they will become a statistic. So we have really encouraged individuals to have access to Narcan. We even wrote a blanket prescription a little bit over a year ago so that if an individual or someone in the family is concerned about their addiction, they can go into a pharmacy and ask for a dose of Narcan with no questions asked and be able to take that home with them. Comprehensive harm reduction programs, something that's very controversial, I understand, but is a needle exchange. Obviously, individuals that are using heroin, if they're using dirty needles, then they have to worry about the problems with infections like hepatitis and HIV, and we certainly don't want individuals who are addicted to end up having more problems. So I'm an advocate for needle exchanges. Our community service boards, we have more funding for them. We really want same-day access. If a patient comes into the emergency room, for example, and has an overdose, they're treated with Narcan. Rather than just send them home and have follow-up, we want them going directly into a CSB and getting the help they need. And then it's great to see, I understand we have some judges with us this morning. Thank you all so much for sharing time with us. But our drug courts and incarceration-based treatment have been very successful, and I think we need to expand those in the Commonwealth. and then finally recovery. The peer recovery specialist, and Ryan is a great example. He's been around the block. He can sit down and talk to other people that are challenged with addiction and let them know that he can help them, and that's just been very powerful. And then supporting the recovery community to combat the stigma. And I touched on that a little bit earlier, but these are people just like you and me, and we need to get past that stigma that these are not good people. So very important. And then just to summarize here, as I said earlier, it's a chronic relapsing disorder. It's not something that goes away overnight, and Ryan can certainly attest to that. It can often be prevented. Again, we need to look at different ways of treating both acute and chronic pain as providers. When prevention fails, there is treatment, and the statistics are actually fairly good. With medically assisted treatment and counseling, about a 60% success rate. So there is hope for these individuals out there. The efforts, I believe, we're following the numbers closely. We still obviously have a lot of work to do, but I think we're headed in a positive direction. And then finally, the primary care and behavioral health are just closely tied together. So I wanted to, for the students and residents, and Ryan has heard me say this before, but when we've been around the block a couple times, it's you live and learn. And so when I came back from Germany in 1992, I had passed my pediatric boards. I had passed my child neurology boards. I was boarded in both neurology and psychiatry with special competence in child neurology. I had all the diplomas on my wall, and I thought I knew everything. And we live and learn. And I wanted to tell you about one of my patients that taught me a lot. And it was a family that came in shortly after I moved back to Norfolk with a 2-year-old toddler who was not looking people in the eye, not communicating, just kind of living in their own little world. And I think anybody that's in developmental medicine or pediatrics or child neurology would easily diagnose a patient like this as being autistic. Not only are we seeing children with autism, but a lot of children in the spectrum, as we say. And so I told the parents of this toddler, I said, your child has autism. I said, there's some tests we can do. I can do an MRI, and we can do an EEG to make sure they're not having temporal lobe seizures, and we can do some genetic tests and some metabolic tests. But I suspect that just looking at your child, if we do these tests, they'll come back and it's normal, and we'll be having the same discussion. And so the family said, well, Dr. Norlin, we would like to have some testing done. And when you tell a family that their child is autistic, it's a right heavy load. And so we did the test, and they came back about 2 weeks later, and sure enough, they were all normal. And I sat with the family, and I said, your child, like I said 2 weeks ago, is autistic, and there's not a whole lot more that I can do for you. I'm sorry. And so they left. They thanked me. And about 10 or 12 years later, I was in the grocery store in Virginia Beach, and a lady came up with her grocery cart, and she said, you're Dr. Northam, aren't you? I said, yes, ma'am, I am. And she said, I don't know if you remember, but we brought our son Logan to see you, and he has autism. And I said, yes, ma'am, I do remember, and I hope you all are doing okay. And she said, well, if you remember, we didn't come back and see you. I said, yes, ma'am, I do remember. And she said, well, let me tell you why we didn't come back. She said, you sat there and looked at us and said, there is nothing more that you can do for our child, and you took our hope away. And when you took our hope away, you took our will to live away. And so my message to you today is, whether you're taking care of someone like Ryan or an autistic child, they come to you not so much for a diagnosis, but they come to you because they want your help. And whether it's treating someone with diabetes or asthma, or if it's end of life, if they're
on their last day or so, there's always something you can do to help that family. So thank you for listening this morning. Number one, don't ever take someone's hope away. But also be aware that this opioid challenge is something that it didn't happen overnight, and it's not going to go away overnight. But if we continue to work together, I really think it's something that we can conquer. So to you, students and residents, work hard, have a good time, go out there and make a difference. Thank you all so much. Brian, thank you, buddy. We have one more down the road.